This is Crime Binge.
Welcome to Crime Binge,
the podcast.
And this week is episode 37.
And we're doing something a little different.
We are.
We decided to take a week off from murder.
Specifically child murder, because it's heavy shit. So this week, we're coming at you with just a crime, no murder involved. And before you turn it off, because you heard no murder, don't be weird. Don't just like murder, like all crime, because you like Crime Binge. Anyway,
exactly.
That has been my PSA.
It is also still crime.
I'm Morgan.
And I'm Sarah.
And we're trying to introduce ourselves more this year.
I also want to talk about the fact that it is cold this week.
It is cold this week for Florida people.
It is currently 53 degrees outside.
It is.
It's probably 53 degrees in here.
That's because the air conditioning is off and I had the door open all day because I was like, ooh, it's nice out.
And Morgan's wearing a comfy.
Here's the thing.
I need everyone to just take a second and look up what the comfy is. C-O-M-F-Y. And it's honestly looks great.
I think it's fantastic.
Is the best thing. It's like, you know how VSCO girls wear the oversized t-shirts?
Yes.
It's like that, but the next level.
It's like the biggest big t-shirt you can wear. And I'm considering wearing it to work because everybody fucking else at work comes in their pajamas. So I might as well come in my comfy.
You should. And there's no shitting on you for it. I just love it. And I need everyone to know what I'm seeing. So like, look it up. Just so you know, hers is maroon.
Yeah.
And like, it's just a big blanket sweatshirt. And I'm going to have to buy one for myself.
To me, it's only like $25.
On the actual website, thecomfy.com, it's $40.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was on sale when I got it.
It's on sale from $45. It's $5 off.
Oh, shit. But yeah, it goes past my knees because I'm a short human being. And it's fantastic. It's essentially a Snuggie without the back cut open to me,
mm-hmm.
which if you
was
have
the
a Snuggie,
worst part,
your back's going to get cold.
I
and
know.
This just, you never get cold. Also, this is the only hoodie I've ever owned in my life that doesn't feel like it's strangling me around my neck.
Fair enough.
It's fantastic. This isn't even my binge. This has been a 3-minute tirade on the fucking comfy, and it is even my binge.
They also have them in different designs.
Like, they have ones that are fleece lined,
some that look like reindeer and elves and an American flag.
The disgust on your face when you said "and an American flag."
Excuse me, you're not supposed to wear things with American flags
it's
on them.
It's true.
But it is a Shark Tank product. But I also wanted to point out that we saw it originally because Grace Helbig wore one.
No, actually.
You didn't see it there? I saw it there originally.
I saw it, a different YouTuber who has the fleece-lined one.
Oh.
And it's Tati Westbrook. She's a beauty guru.
Okay,
and
I saw it through Grace Helbig.
Yeah, she was dancing around and playing piano in her comfy, and I was like, what the fuck? And then Grace had one, and I was like, what is this? And it's honestly changed my life. I got it on Friday and I've literally worn it every single day since.
And like, the thing is, you don't have to wear pants with it.
No, I didn't wear pants with it the entire weekend. It was fantastic.
That's amazing.
It's great. It's my new depression clothing.
Well, on that note,
Sarah's like, oh, don't talk about that. What are you binging this week, though? Let's get off of the comfy, because
okay. This week I am binging another Netflix show called, because that's all I watch apparently.
That's fine.
Called Sugar Rush.
Okay.
And it's like one of those like typical baking competition shows, because I used to watch like Cupcake Wars and stuff.
Yeah.
Except it's different in two ways. A, they do different challenges each round. So they do like a confection, like a cookie, and then a cupcake, and then a cake.
Yeah.
But instead of each team having like 2 hours to do this round and 2 hours to do this or whatever, they have like 3 or 4 hours, I don't remember which one, for the whole thing.
Okay.
And as they finish, they like hit a buzzer and then can move on to the next round. And so like by the end, you want to have the most amount of time left for your biggest thing. But also they eliminate someone every round. So like, let's say you're done first with round one and it takes another 20 minutes for everyone else to finish round one. And you're halfway through doing your shit for round two. You can then be eliminated from round one because they don't do the elimination until everyone is done with round one.
Damn.
And so it's just like a different element of a fucking baking show because I love baking shows. And so I thought it was really interesting because all baking shows are the same. And this one had something different. So I thought it was pretty cool.
That is really cool. I like that.
What is your binge?
So my binge this week is a... like artist slash podcast.
Okay.
So it's this guy who goes by the artist name of Sleeping At Last, and he makes music, but he did an album where he did a song for each of the Enneagram types, and he like spoke with people from that type and like researched that type. And then wrote a song based on, like, what he thinks that type really, like, envelops, I guess.
I'm going to have to listen to what my type is.
Yeah, it's really fun. And he also has a podcast version where he explains every single portion of the song to you. So you, like, get a deeper understanding of it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I heard the song for a six, because that's what I am, I... like literally teared up when I heard the song, and I was like, wow, I've never felt more seen. So if you like the Enneagram or like believe in the Enneagram,
and Morgan
really
loves
fun.
It.
I do. It's
she makes
very
everyone
fun.
Take it. But I, for the record, am a nine.
Yes, Sarah's a nine. Which apparently it's actually rude in some cultures to tell people what your number is because it's supposed to be for yourself.
What the fuck ever.
But don't go like psychoanalyzing us based on our numbers, please, for the love of God. But yeah, it's just really interesting. And it's, I think like the basis of what he does is really cool. Like to take something that you might not know fully and like all that. And I think he, if I remember correctly, is a nine. So he wrote them in numerical order. So he wrote his song last too.
Oh, wow.
So... just kind of interesting.
That is very I've never heard of, I mean, I hadn't even heard of the Enneagram before you, so
two different people at work like mentioned it to me within the same week of one another, and I was like, okay, I'll give it a shot. But should we get into today's episode?
We definitely should.
All right, because we spent approximately 5 minutes on the comfy earlier.
It's fun. And now it's getting late.
But this week, we are covering the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist.
Yeah.
A mouthful.
An art heist. And the Gardner Museum heist resulted in the biggest art theft and largest private property theft in the world to this date. And it happened when two thieves stole 13 pieces of artwork, totaling $500 million at the time.
Yeah. So this is a story with twists and turns, and none of them involve murder. Actually, there is a little bit of murder involved. Not a lot, but it's not even really in regards to the museum itself.
I'm going to be honest. I almost started singing the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air song when you said, this is a story all about how...
Get out of here. I'm sure that's a copyright or something.
I know. That's why I stopped.
I'm proud of you. But to just give you like a brief history, we will not bore you too much with the details of the actual museum, but to give you a little background on it, the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum is located at 25 Evans Way in Boston, Massachusetts. The museum was built from 1898 to 1903 by Isabella Stewart Gardner and architect Willard T. Sears. I wonder if he created Sears.
Maybe.
Just kidding. Probably not. Isabel was born in New York City on April 14th, 1840. As a girl, she traveled a lot and even went to school in Paris, so she was a sophisticated lady. Mm-hmm. In 1857, she was taken to Italy, where she saw, wow.
Wait, I got it.
No, I just realized, like, this entire thing is foreign names, and we're just the most ignorant-ass people.
It's Jean Giacomo Poldi Pezzolis.
Okay. I'm not going to repeat that, no. But she saw his collection of Renaissance art, where she decided that if she ever inherited any money, she would build a similar house where people could visit and enjoy art. The next year, she returned to the U.S., where she met Jack Gardner, one of Boston's most eligible bachelors, and the two got married in 1860. They were socialites, and they spent about 12 years traveling the globe. And this is where Isabella started collecting small pieces of art. In 1891, she inherited $1.75 million from her father, which is about $50 million today.
Which is a nice amount.
Yeah, that's a nice inheritance. And this is when she started seriously collecting art, focusing on European fine art. And this included Vermeer's The Concert. Is it Botticelli's? Mm-hmm. Botticelli's Madonna and Child, Titian's The Rape of Europa, and many others from artists such as Rembrandt, Michelangelo, Raphael, and even some early manuscripts of Dante's The Divine Comedy, which is super fucking cool.
And also, like, she got two out of the four Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in there. So, like, good on her.
See that door, Sarah? You gotta get the fuck out.
Nah.
Just I'm kidding. Good. We have to finish recording this.
I'm hilarious.
Isabella worked with American art historian Bernard Bernison to help acquire over 70 pieces of artwork for her collection. After her husband died in 1898, Isabella decided to start the plans on building the museum to house all of her art, which was her dream since she was a little girl.
Yeah. So, the museum is designed to emulate a 15th century Venetian palace. Its grand opening was January 1st, 1903, and that was just to Isabella's, like, socialite friends and artists, and then it opened to the public a few months later. When Isabella died in 1924, she died when she was 84 years old from a stroke.
Which is pretty good in those days.
Yeah. But her will created an endowment of $1 million for the support of the museum, including the stipulation that the permanent collection was not to be altered for the education and enjoyment of the public for forever. And she did also continue collecting art for the museum up until the time that she died.
Yeah.
The museum itself is three floors, with the fourth floor that Isabella once lived in, and it's now used as, like, offices, and the whole museum sits inside of a garden courtyard.
Okay.
The walls of the galleries have art from floor to ceiling, and Isabella's collection ended up being more than 7,500 paintings, sculptures, furniture, textiles, ceramics, and silver, 1,500 rare books, and 7,000 archival objects from ancient Rome, medieval Europe, Renaissance Italy, Asia, the Islamic world, and 19th century France and America. So she was everywhere.
Yeah, that's pretty fucking cool, though. Yeah. Like, that's a really cool collection.
Yeah, I love, like, art and stuff like that.
Yeah, and I think, because on our Instagram, obviously, we'll put up, like, some photos from today. But just seeing, like, glimpses of the inside of the museum is mm-hmm. really cool, because it is just floor to ceiling, and it's, like, I don't know. It's, what's that word? Like, collage, almost. Like, yeah. It's a collage of fine art, so it's kind of fun. But by the 1980s, the museum had started running low on funds, and this caused the museum to be left in poor conditions, unfortunately. It didn't have a climate control system or an insurance policy, And it was in great need of basic building maintenance and as well as a better security system. And just like seeing that it didn't have climate control
makes me cringe.
So uncomfortable.
Yes.
In 1982, the FBI discovered a plot by Boston criminals to rob the museum, and then more money was allocated towards better security. 60 infrared motion detectors were installed inside of the building, more security guards were hired, and 4 security cameras were placed covering the outside of the building to a closed-circuit TV at the guard station. The Board of Trustees for the museum voted against placing security cameras inside of the building, thinking that it would be too expensive. Like, just maybe one or two.
Right?
You know? But the only way that the security guards could call the police was by pushing a button at the guard station. This differed vastly from other museums, who had to call the police once an hour after closing to inform them that all was well. In 1988, an independent security consultant reviewed the museum and recommended improvements, even though they were apparently on par with similar museums in the area. The Board of Trustees again denied the improvements based on financials and Isabella's wishes against renovations. The board also denied higher salaries for the security guards in order to attract more qualified candidates. At the time, the guards were being paid only slightly more than minimum wage. Also, what is, like, why would you deny higher salaries to attract more qualified candidates?
Because they were running out of money in general.
Oh, never mind. The way I read that was like,
Okay.
I'm being dumb. Never mind. I thought like it was on purpose that they were trying to attract more qualified people with less money. And I was like, that's not how that works, guys.
Now moving on to the actual heist. The robbery began in the early hours of the morning on Sunday, March 18th of 1990. The thieves were first noticed by St. Patrick Day partiers around 12:30 a.m. near the museum. The two men were dressed like police officers and were parked in a hatchback on Palace Road, and this was about 100 feet from the entrance. Most of the witnesses assume these men were just actual police officers. The museum was being guarded by Rick Abbath and Randy Hestand on this evening. Abbath was a regular to the night shift, but it was Hestand's first night. The security policy in place at the time was that one guard patrolled the galleries with a walkie-talkie and a flashlight, while the others sat at the security desk. Abbath was first to go on patrol because he had done this before, and while he was on patrol, fire alarms sounded off in different rooms in the museum, but he could not locate any fire or smoke. He returned to the security room, where the fire alarm control panel also indicated smoke in multiple rooms. He just assumed that this was a malfunction and turned the panel off. He decided to go back on patrol, and before he completed his rounds, he went to a side entrance of the museum, briefly opening the side door and shutting it again. Abbath didn't tell Hestand that he did this or even why. He completed his rounds and returned to the security desk around 1 a.m., where Hestand began his rounds. The thieves arrived around 1:20 a.m., and they drove up to the side entrance, parked, and walked up to the side door. They rang the buzzer, which connected them to Abbath, through an intercom, where they explained that they were reporting to investigate a disturbance that had been reported and that they needed to come in. Abbath could see them on the closed-circuit television, and from what he could tell, they were in real police uniforms. He also said that he didn't know of a disturbance, but assumed that one of the St. Patrick's Day's revelers had jumped the fence or something, and it had been called in, so he let the men in at 1:24 a.m. They were led into a locked foyer that separated the side door from the museum, and they approached Abbath at his desk.
When they approached, they asked him if anyone else was in the museum, and they instructed Abath to call him down. Abath did what he was told and called Hestan down. And around this time, Abath noted that the mustache on the taller of the policemen looked to kind of be fake.
What I think is so weird is, like, why let them in at all, even if you just think that they might have seen somebody, like, jump the fence? Like, you know, yeah. Like, they should just stay outside and check around and see if they're there, personally. But whatever, we'll get into why this is all weird. The shorter man told Abath that he looked familiar and that they might have a warrant out for his arrest. They asked him to come out from behind the desk and instructed him to provide identification. He complied and stepped away from the desk, and this desk was actually the only place that there was a panic button to notify police. The shorter man forced Abath against a wall, spread his legs, and handcuffed him. Abath said that he noticed later that he had not been frisked, so probably wasn't a real police officer. Yeah. Around this time, Hestan walked into the room and the taller man handcuffed him. Once the two guards were handcuffed, the thieves informed them of their true intentions to rob the museum and asked the guards to not give them any problems. The two men were then wrapped in duct tape around their eyes, just, like, completely wrapped around their head, which, like, no, can you imagine you. Over your eyebrows and stuff? Yeah, I hate that.
Just give me a blindfold.
Yeah, for real. The two thieves then led the guards down into the basement to handcuff them to a steam pipe and workbench, respectively. And what was interesting is that they did this without asking for directions, so they knew where the basement was. They also took the guards' wallets and told them, "We now know where you live," and also said if they didn't tell the authorities that the men had been there, that they would get a reward in about a year. Like, what kind of, like...
Yeah, reward would you get?
Yeah, it just feels weird. It took the thieves only about 11 minutes to subdue the guards, and by this time it was about 1:35 a.m., their movement was tracked throughout the museum because it was being recorded on infrared motion detectors. Their first steps were not recorded in the Dutch room until about 1:48 a.m., and this room was on the second floor. Because it was about 13 minutes after the guards were subdued, investigators later believed that they might have been waiting to see if any police had been notified before moving on.
So... in the Dutch room, there was a device that began beeping if you got too close to a painting. So the thieves smashed this when they entered the room. So they had known about that.
Yeah.
In this room, they took The Storm on the Sea of Galilee and A Lady and Gentleman in Black, where they just threw them on the marble floor, which shattered their glass frames. Using a blade, they then cut the canvases out of their stretchers.
Which, like, what kind of terrible person treats art like that?
Like, coming from us used to frame artwork. Like,
yeah, like, this hurts my soul.
It does. So they also removed a large Rembrandt self-portrait oil painting from the wall, but then left it leaning against a cabinet. And later, investigators believe that they may have considered it too large to transport, because it was painted on wood and not canvas, so they couldn't, like, cut it up and roll it.
Yeah.
Instead, they took a small postage stamp size self-portrait etching by Rembrandt on display beneath the larger portrait. They also removed landscape with obelisk and the concert from their frames. The final piece taken from the room was an ancient Chinese gu. At 1:51 a.m., one thief continued working in the Dutch room and the other entered a narrow hallway that they had earned the name the Short Gallery on the other side of the second floor. And shortly after, the other thief joined him. In the Short Gallery, they began removing screws for a frame that was displaying a Napoleonic.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Like Napoleon.
Yeah. Napoleonic flag. And it appeared that they were trying to steal the flag. they appeared to have given up halfway through and just took the eagle finial atop the flagpole. And a finial is an element marking the top or end of an object, often like a decorative feature. And the eagle finial was an insignia of Napoleon's Imperial Guard. That comes back later. So they also took the Tortoni from the blue room on the first floor. The motion detectors did not detect any motion within the blue room during the thieves' time in the building. The only motion that was detected in that room that night were Abbott's when he passed through the gallery while patrolling earlier. Bom, bom, bom.
When it was time to leave, the thieves checked on the guards one last time and asked them if they were comfortable, like the mom from Mean Girls.
Yeah, right?
They then went to the security director's office where they took the video cassettes that recorded their entrance to the museum, and they also took the data printouts from the motion detective equipment. But the movement data was still on a hard drive that remained untouched. And the frame for the Ches Torini was also left at the security director's desk. The thieves then moved to take the artwork out of the museum, and the side entrance doors were opened once at 2:40 a.m. and then one last time at 2:45, meaning that they took two separate trips to take all of the artwork to their vehicle. The robbery lasted in total about 81 minutes. And the next morning, the next shift of guards realized something was wrong pretty quickly when they could not contact anyone on the inside to be let in. They called in a security director, and when he entered the building with his keys, he found nobody at the watch desk and called the police. The police searched the building until they found the guards still tied up in the basement. In total, 13 works were stolen. And in 1990, the FBI estimated the value of the haul at $200 million, and this was then again raised in 2000 to $500 million. And in the late 2000s, some art dealers suggested the haul could now be worth more than $600 million. The most valuable works that were taken from the Dutch room was actually one of like the most important paintings as well. And this was the Concert by Dutch painter Vermeer. And this was so special because he only had 34 paintings in total that were ever attributed to him. And now one of them was missing. This painting alone accounts for half of the haul's value, estimated at $250 million in 2015. In the same room, the thieves targeted paintings by Rembrandt, and included the Storm on the Sea of Galilee, his only seascape, and the most valuable of his works that were stolen that night. Estimates on this have placed this work at over $100 million. Another Rembrandt work that was taken was A Lady and Gentleman in Black, which was apparently about the size of a small postage stamp, and it was also like a self-portrait etching. And this work had previously been stolen before, actually, but it was returned in 1970 and lived there again until it was taken. Landscape with Obelisk was largely thought to be a Rembrandt painting, like as this was a longstanding thought, but it was discovered a few years before the like robbery happened that Govert Flinck had actually created this piece of art. And they think that the reason why the thieves took it was because they thought it was a Rembrandt and that they'd be able to get more money for it if they sold it.
So the pieces taken from the short gallery were five sketches done by Edgar Degas. They were done on paper and they were relatively small, done in inks, washes, and charcoal. These have a small value compared to most of the other pieces, and all five are worth under $100,000 combined. The eclectic mix of items that were taken has puzzled experts for years. Some of the pieces were valuable, but they passed up on more valuable works done by Raphael, Botticelli, and Michelangelo. The thieves also never entered the third floor, where the most valuable painting in the entire city was held. And this painting was The Rape of Europa, which was created by Titian.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Mm-hmm. The selection of pieces led investigators to believe that the people who committed the robbery were not experts commissioned to steal particular pieces.
Like, they hadn't probably done this before.
Mm-mm. So Gardner's will decreed nothing in her collection should be moved. So the empty frames for the stolen paintings remain hanging in the respective locations in the museum as placeholders for their potential return. And those are still hanging today.
Yeah, which I think is really cool.
Mm-hmm. Because of the museum's low funds and lack of an insurance policy, the director asked for help from the Sotheby's and Christie's auction houses to post a reward for $1 million within the first 3 days after the robbery. This was again increased to $5 million in 1997, and in 2017, it was doubled to $10 million with an expiration date set for the end of the year. And there is also a separate $100,000 reward for the return of the Napoleon Bronze Eagle finale. Finial. That's how you pronounce it.
It was like you haven't said it the other way the yep. whole time.
So this reward was actually extended past the end of the year following an outpouring of tips from the public, and it is the largest bounty ever offered by a private institution. Federal prosecutors have stated that anyone who willingly returns the items will not be prosecuted, and the statute of limitations expired in 1995 anyways, so the thieves couldn't be prosecuted even if they brought the artwork in.
Yeah, which is super interesting because statute of limitations are really weird things.
Yeah,
because
that's only 5 years later.
Yeah, for $500 million.
I know. Like, it's just because it's like personal theft.
Yeah. So now we're going to start taking a look at like who could have done it.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI took immediate control of the case when it occurred because it was very likely that the art would be crossing state lines. Investigators find this case to be interesting and unique as there is a lack of strong physical evidence. They, like the robbers, did not leave any footprints behind or hair, and it's inconclusive if the fingerprints that were found were from the thieves or museum employees themselves. And since there have been advancements in the field, the FBI ran more DNA analysis, but some of the evidence, unfortunately, has been lost among their files. The guards and witnesses in the street described one thief as about 5'9 in his late 30s with a medium build, and the other as 6 or 6'1 in his early 30s with a heavier build. So, naturally, the main suspect originally is Rick Abbath, who was always, as soon as I was reading this case, I was like, it was definitely the guard. Like, he's a weird guy. So he was considered a suspect early on because of his suspicious behavior that night. When he was on patrol, he opened and shut the side door, and he told authorities that he did this often while he was working in order to double check if that door was closed. But one of Abbott's colleagues told journalists that if he had opened the door that regularly, the supervisor would have seen it on the computer printouts and would have asked him to stop because that wasn't part of their protocol. More suspicion arose as they did not detect any movement in the blue room during the robbery, but only when Abbath had patrolled, like, earlier.
And one of the artworks was gone.
Yeah. Abbath maintains his innocence. This is my favorite part. Abbath maintains his innocence, and the FBI agents on the case determined early on that the guards were too incompetent to pull something off like this, which is just my favorite.
Like, definitely they weren't part of it, but I feel like he probably got paid to let them in or something.
Yeah, like he definitely knew that he was gonna be tied up and like let them in for sure. Yeah. There's no way he didn't. In 2015, the FBI released a video from the museum showing Abbott letting in an unidentified man into the museum to converse at the security desk. He told investigators that he could not recall this incident or recognize the man, so they released the video to the public to see if anyone could recognize this person. And several former museum guards came forward and said that the stranger was Abbott's boss, the deputy security chief of the museum.
But, like, how do you not recognize your own boss?
Yeah, I mean, it is, like...
15 years later or whatever.
No.
25 years later.
Yeah, 25 years later, and who knows how old he was at the time. But I feel like, why would you open and close that side door if it wasn't a signal to someone on the outside to be like, come on in.
Yeah. So one of the next suspects was a man named Whitey Bulger.
Why'd you say it like no one knows who he is?
Okay, but is it Bulger or Bulger? Because I've heard it both ways.
I couldn't tell you. Like, I want to say one or the other, but I know that I'm going to be wrong if I tell you. So I'm just not going to.
So Whitey Bulger, Bulger, whatever. was one of the most powerful crime bosses in Boston at the time. He was the head of the Winter Hill Gang, and the Winter Hill Gang were predominantly of Irish and Italian descent, and they were active from 1955 to 1999. They committed typical organized crime and were most known for fixing horse races and sending weapons to the Irish Republican Army. Bulger claimed that he did not organize this crime, and he also sent out his own agents to figure out who did, as the crime was committed on his turf, and he wanted to be paid tribute. He was like, fuck no, people don't do this shit. So the FBI agent who investigated Bulger and the Winter Hill Gang was Thomas McShane. He knew that Bulger had strong ties with the Boston police, and thought that this was a way that the thieves could obtain realistic police uniforms. He also knew that Bulger had a relationship with the Irish Republican Army, and the fact that the fire alarms were tripped beforehand was actually a signature of theirs.
Interesting.
But Agent McShane's investigation did not produce any information to tie Bulger or the Irish Republican Army to the heist. Bulger eventually ended up on the FBI's most wanted list for a ton of different crimes, including multiple counts of murder. So he was captured and he died in prison in 2018 at the age of 89 by being beaten to death by fellow inmates.
Interesting.
Yeah. And that's all I wrote about that because it was real graphic what happened to him.
Oh, yeah. Also, like, he's a very, like, well-known character. We could talk about him alone for an entire episode. Do you want to know a fun fact?
Always.
One time, I wrote a report on the Irish Republican Army in school.
Really?
I could not tell you why, for what class, but I know I have a vivid memory of writing that paper. So, one of the other suspects is Brian McDevitt. He was a con man from Boston who had tried to steal a Rembrandt painting from the Hyde Collection in New York in 1981, but had failed. To commit this crime, he had dressed up as a FedEx driver and carried duct tape and handcuffs. He fit the description of the taller robber from the Gardner Museum, except for his red hair. So the FBI interviewed him in late 1990. McDevitt denied any involvement and refused to take a polygraph test. His fingerprints did not match any at the crime scene, and he soon moved to California, where he conned his way into television and film writing, which sounds about right. Mm-hmm. In 1992, he admitted to his girlfriend at the time that he had been paid $300,000 to rob the Gardner Museum, and he had to leave the country. He died in Colombia in 2004 at 43 years old.
So in 1994, there was this weird letter that was sent to the museum.
because people love writing letters to be creepy. Mm-hmm. No one just writes a letter to be nice anymore.
And Anne Hawley, who was the museum director, received that letter in 1994. The letter stated that they were a third-party negotiator and wanted to attempt to negotiate the return of the artwork. They stated that they did not know who the thieves were, but that the artwork was stolen in order to reduce a prison sentence, but the opportunity had passed and there was no longer any motive to hold on to the artwork. But, like, besides the fact that it's worth $500 million.
Yeah.
So the letter also assured that the artwork was safe and it was being held in climate-controlled conditions in a non-common law country. The negotiations stated that there would be immunity for all involved and that they wanted $2.6 million for the return of the artwork that would be wired to an offshore bank account, which at the time there was only $1 million being offered for the reward. The writer also gave information that was only known by the museum and the FBI at the time in order to, like, say that he was legit. If the museum was interested in the deal, they were to send a coded message in the Boston Globe. Anne Hawley felt as though this was a strong lead and contacted the FBI. They then printed a coded message in the Boston Globe, which was released in the May 1st, 1994 edition. A few days later, Anne Hawley received a second letter. This letter stated that they knew the museum was interested in negotiating, but it also said that the writer feared that there was an investigation into finding out who their identity was, and they didn't want to risk getting caught. They said that they needed some time to think about their options, but Anne Hawley never heard from the writer again.
That's unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
Because even the FBI was like, let's take this seriously. Yeah. There was also a large look into the Boston Mafia as being potentially responsible for the theft. And specifically the Merlino gang. Right, Merlino?
Yeah.
In 2013, the FBI announced that they had made significant progress in the investigation and said that they could announce, quote, with a high degree of confidence, unquote, that they had identified the thieves. High degree of confidence, and we still don't know where the art is.
Right.
They believed the thieves were a member of a criminal organization based in the Mid-Atlantic and New England. They also said that they felt the artwork was transported to Connecticut and Philadelphia in the years following the theft. The goods were said to have been attempted to be sold in Philadelphia in 2002. This is where the FBI's knowledge runs out, and they requested the public help them locate the artwork. In 2015, the FBI said both of the thieves were dead, and they were never publicly identified. But sources familiar with the investigation said that they were associated with a gang from Dorchester. This gang was loyal to Boston Mafia boss Frank Salame?
Yeah.
Frank Salame, and ran their operations out of an auto repair shop run by criminal Carmelo Merlino. Merlino's associates had gained knowledge of the museum's weakness after a gangster named Louis Royce cased it in 1981. He made plans to light up smoke bombs and rush the galleries during the confusion, which is just a bad plan, Royce. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm sorry. In 1982, undercover FBI agents learned of their interest in robbing the Gardner Museum during an investigation into another theft. The FBI told the museum of the gang's plans, and this is when the museum ramped up its security. This man, Royce, was in jail during the time of the robbery, though, so he could not have committed it.
Some men associated with the Merlino gang were Robert Guantin and Robert Gentile.
Guantin? Where? Guarente?
Guarente?
Yeah.
I don't know how to say
it's,
names.
It's not the first one. There wasn't an N in the middle.
Fair enough. Guarente?
Yeah, I would say like Guarente or something like that.
Okay.
So Robert Guarente died from cancer in 2004, and his widow Elaine told the FBI in 2010 that her husband had previously owned some of the missing paintings. She said that when he got sick with cancer in the early 2000s, that he gave his paintings to Gentile. Gentile denied these accusations and said he never knew of the whereabouts of the art. In 2012, Gentile was indicted on drug charges in an attempt to pressure him for information about the missing pieces of art. He took a polygraph test, which came back that he was lying about not having information on the theft of the artwork. He demanded a retest, and this time he said once Elaine had showed him the missing Rembrandt self-portrait and the machine indicated he was telling the truth. A few days after this, and another retest, the FBI went to Gentile's house with a search warrant. They found a secret ditch beneath a false door in the backyard's shed, but it was empty. Gentile's son said that the ditch had flooded a few years prior, and that his father had been very upset about whatever was being stored there that had gotten destroyed. In the basement of his home, they also found a copy of the Boston Herald from March 1990 reporting the theft, and there was also a piece of paper indicating what each piece might sell on the black market. Gentile went to prison for 30 months, and when he got out of prison, he spoke with a reporter named Stephen Curjan and claimed that he was framed by the FBI. He also described that the list of valuables were written up by a criminal trying to broker a return for the works from Guarente, and was talking to Gentile as an
intermediary.
Thank you,
intermediary. You're
welcome. I am really bad at words. When he was asked about the small ditch, he said that he could recall what had been damaged, but believed that it could have been small motors.
He could not recall. Sorry.
He couldn't recall what had been damaged, but believed that it was small motors.
Which, like, you know what was damaged.
Yeah.
So, David Turner was another associate. David Turner was another associate of Merlino. In 1992, the FBI began investigating him when they learned that he may know where the paintings were. Merlino was arrested that year for cocaine trafficking charges and was told that he could return the paintings for a reduced sentence. Turner could not come up with the paintings, but heard that they were in a church in South Boston. Turner had actually been in Florida picking up a cocaine shipment at the time of the heist, according to credit card statements, but some speculate that this could have just been an alibi that they concocted. In 1999, the FBI arrested Turner, Merlino, Rossetti, and others in a sting operation the day that they had planned to rob a Loomis Largo vault. When questioning Turner, the FBI stated that they knew that he had involvement in the heist and would let them go if he returned the paintings. He originally stated that he had no idea where the paintings were, and in his trial, he claimed entrapment by the FBI, stating that the FBI let the Loomis plot proceed so they could pressure him into getting information about the Gardner heist. But that didn't work, and he was found guilty in 2001. In 2010, Turner wrote a letter to Robert Gentile asking if he could contact his ex-girlfriend to help assist in recovering the Gardner paintings. Gentile spoke with Turner's ex, and she told him to contact two of Turner's ex-convict friends in Boston. The FBI wanted Gentile to meet with the two men and to send an undercover FBI agent with him, but Gentile decided that he didn't want to cooperate further, and the lead fell short. David Turner was released from prison in November of 2019, and Merlino died in prison in 2005.
So moving on to the investigation today. Anthony Amore is the current chief of security of the Gardner Museum and has been since 2005. The walls of his office are covered in pictures of the 13 artworks that were stolen. He says, I'm still wildly obsessed, more than ever. I constantly think about those paintings. Jeffrey Kelly has been the lead FBI agent on the case since 2002. He works closely with Amore and considers himself equally obsessed. On the wall of his basement is the recreation of The Storm on the Sea of Galilee. His wife had given him the painting and frayed the edges because the real one was cut from its frame, which I thought was super cute.
Yeah, that's sweet.
There have been more than 30,000 leads, as well as forensic tests, hunches, psychics, jailhouse confessions, and hundreds of interviews with mobsters, police officers, museum staff, and art dealers from all over the world, and authorities are still no closer to knowing the whereabouts of the artwork.
Yeah.
Otto Noman, who is a senior vice president of Sotheby's, which is one of the world's largest brokers of fine art, says that the art market has skyrocketed and the worth of the paintings has increased significantly. He says, quote, it's at least $1 billion. The Vermeer alone is worth nearly $500 million. And that he said that in 2019. In 2018, there was a lead that sent investigators down to Florida, but to no avail. There has never been any demands for ransom for the artwork, but the FBI still gets tips every week. They say that some of the same callers have been pestering the FBI for years, some since 2013. One strange call that they said that they've gotten says that JFK Jr. and his wife were the thieves and that they faked their own death to cover up the heist.
Likely story.
Right? So Agent Kelly says that they receive two types of tips. One tip is suggesting that they know who stole the art, and the second are people saying that they know where the art is. Kelly says that they try to investigate all the tips, but, you know, sometimes it's hard because the people that they need to interview may be deceased at this point.
Right.
And all the suspects are told about the immunity because of the statute of limitations and the $10 million reward. And Kelly also quotes, I'll investigate any viable theory, but there comes a time when enough is enough. And this is when he was talking about, like, the ridiculous tips that come in.
Yeah. I like that this case is kind of like the, Zodiac killer of art heists.
Right?
Because they just, like, get calls every week still.
Mm-hmm.
Agent Kelly is one of the people who worked with and interviewed Richard Gentile. He says that if Gentile told us everything he knows, we'd be further along on our recovery efforts. He also says that they are confident that they know who committed the crime, but that they still don't have the art. He doesn't know if the art is still all together or if it has been split up. I would assume it's been split up, personally. Mm-hmm. They have received leads that some of the art is in Corsica, which is an island in France, which I definitely just butchered. So sorry to that island in France. This was investigated in 2006 when an undercover agent, Robert Whitman, went to Corsica with interest in buying the paintings. He was told that the Vermeer and some of the Rembrandts were being held by a gang, and he was unable to pursue the lead any further, though, because of these gang wars. The French police also believed that the Eagle Finial was in Corsica, and Whitman stated, why would the thieves steal a Napoleonic Finial instead of another painting? Because Napoleon was from Corsica.
Bum, bum, bum.
Bum, bum, bum. There have also been leads stating that the paintings are in Dublin, Ireland, but there is no evidence to back this up. The FBI currently believes that some of the artwork was sold in Philadelphia and that some people may be in possession of the paintings and have no idea what they actually have. Many visitors come to the museum to look at the empty frames that showcase where the paintings used to be. After talking to some of the patrons, Amore says, I've talked to people who used to come here as students, but they haven't come back because to them, the theft is so sad. Amore also created a database on his computers where he keeps track of everyone that investigators have talked to regarding the case. He says, I enter every piece of information about every person of interest we've heard about. I stopped counting, but there are at least 30,000 different pieces of information, addresses, phone numbers, vehicle information, biographical data, places of employment. It helps us when I get a new phone call and saves a lot of time. That would be nice, though, to have a giant cross-reference of data.
And, like, it's him that's doing it and not the FBI.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Gardner Museum website says that they are still accepting information with a $10 million reward for the return of this artwork, as it is still a top priority at the museum. So anyone with information should contact Anthony Amore directly with confidentiality and anonymity guaranteed. And you can easily just look that up, the Gardner Museum, and it'll bring you to that site. Mm-hmm. And it talks about the theft like a lot on their museum as well. But yeah, that's a freaking art heist, guys.
Yeah, and it's still unsolved.
Still an unsolved art heist. I feel like it's going to be one of those things where, like, what are those, like, container wars where people, go and find an empty container and pay, like, $100 for everything inside, and they're going to, like, find a fucking Rembrandt or something.
Honestly, would be amazing.
I feel like that's just eventually what's going to happen with all of that art.
I'd pay to watch it.
But we hope that you guys enjoyed taking a little bit of break from murder this week. As much as that is interesting, sometimes you need a palate cleanser and you need just some good old traditional mob crime.
And are you ready for a Florida man palate cleanser?
Yes, I am.
So the title of this is Florida Man's Job Application Leads to His Arrest in a 1998 Cold Case Murder.
Oh, wow.
So my computer is currently having a stroke.
Cool.
But basically, I already read the article, thank God. Last year, this guy named Todd Barker, who was 51 years old, put in an application, and he had to, like, be fingerprinted for his job. And they basically took the fingerprints and ran them in the system. Like, I guess this job just gives the fingerprints to the police.
Oh, okay.
For, like, a background check. And it ended up matching an unsolved murder in 1998 where this woman was, like, stabbed and bludgeoned to death where she was working at a consignment shop and they fucking arrested him.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
That's actually so cool.
Yeah, it's crazy. And, like, the detective said that they were working for years to trying to find the killer. And, it just so happened that he worked at this place that submitted fingerprints for background checks.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Also, I like how you had to bring murder into it this week, Sarah.
I did. I didn't even mean to.
I'm just kidding. That's really interesting. I'd actually like to look into that case more if there's anything about it. But we hope that you guys liked this week's episode, and if you did, make sure you leave us a 5-star review. Also check us out on social media, but we shall see you guys next week, and
keep on binging.
Bye.
See ya.